Hudson Enterprises, Inc. versus F.A. Carter County, heating and air conditioning, Inc., Holiday Care, Elizabeth M. LeBlanc, Carter Alderley, and Helen Trumbull, Jeffrey J. Ogleman, John E. Flynn, John P. Flynn, Abilene County.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Joe Oliveri, and I represent the appellant, Ferguson Enterprises. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my argument for rebuttal.
All right.
Your Honors, this appeal presents a simple and straightforward question. Did the circuit court reversibly err when it denied Ferguson's motion to strike and also refused to allow Ferguson to present its statute of limitations defense to the jury at trial based solely on its admittedly mistaken belief that it had previously denied Ferguson's statute of limitations plea when in fact it had not? That is absolutely reversible error. This case, Your Honors, exemplifies why Virginia has a 2-year statute of limitations for fraud. And if the judgment is not reversed, this case will effectively eliminate Virginia's statute of limitations on fraud and open the floodgates to decades-old claims. F.H. Furr, the plaintiff, a sophisticated business, filed this case in 2013, claiming fraud based on recollections of decades-old conversations. Thus, one of Ferguson's key defense theories was that F.H. Furr's claims were barred by the statute of limitations, and it pled the affirmative defense of the statute of limitations.
Let me ask you, was statute of limitations listed as an affirmative defense in any of your answers?
Here, Your Honor, Ferguson raised the affirmative defense of the statute of limitations in a plea and bar. Under the Virginia Code, the statute of limitations need only be raised in a responsive pleading. Here, Ferguson filed its statute of limitations plea and bar, and the court reserved ruling on that, finding that it required fact-finding.
Do you think that the plea and bar needed to be refiled when they were given leave to amend?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, the court's order entered on June 10th of 2014 effectively prohibited Ferguson from doing that. What the order specified was this. But after the first amended complaint that F.H. Furr filed was denied, Ferguson's demur was granted as to the non-fraud counts, and the plea was carried forward, was a deferred ruling on the plea as to Ferguson's, or F.H. Furr's fraud counts, excuse me. The court entered an order requiring a very specific repleading with regard to the second amended complaint. With regard to the plaintiff, the court ordered that it must replead its fraud claims verbatim. Could not change those. And could replead additional claims differently, such as unjust enrichment claims. Here, with regard to Ferguson, the court ordered that Ferguson file an answer to the fraud claims and responsive pleadings to the other claims. Ferguson complied with that order. It filed an answer to F.H. Furr's identically repleaded fraud claims and other responsive pleadings, including special pleas to the other claims.
And he held in abeyance a decision on your then-existing on-the-table plea and bar.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. It would have been entirely duplicative as well to replead.
It would have been quite different if he had denied the plea and bar. You get that, right?
That's correct. The plea, he expressly deferred ruling and said that it could not be ruled on, either granted or denied at that time, because fact-finding was required.
And then he limited your repleading to an answer as opposed to a general responsive pleading.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Oliveri, it is an unusual way for the court to deal with it, but in fact, that's what he ordered. So I understand your position, and I would probably be a bit unfair to suggest that that was your fault. But having said that, there's another reason for the judge's opinion, and I just want to read out loud what the judge said.
Yes, Your Honor.
And let you respond to this. Even if the special pleas have survived the filing of the second amended complaint. At no time over the next 2.5 years did Ferguson attempt to raise the special pleas or put them before the court for a hearing. It is incumbent on a party asserting a claim or defense to bring it to the court's attention and request a timely decision.
No.
If the failure to refile the pleas did not constitute a waiver, the failure to docket them for a hearing did. What is your response to that?
Mr. Chief Justice, our response is that under Virginia law, there is no authority that requires a separate hearing before, in this case, a separate jury that would raise entirely duplicative issues on a plea and bar separate and apart from trial. This court has held that to preserve the statute of limitations defense, a defendant need only raise the statute of limitations in a responsive pleading and then additionally raise it in a motion to strike at trial. That's the McDonald's case cited in the briefing. And, Your Honor, courts routinely resolve disputed facts related to pleas and bar at trial. There is just no requirement that a separate jury be convened during a separate hearing at a separate time, which would run the risk of inconsistent judgments, and in a complex case like this, where facts are overlapping, be a complete waste of the court's and the party's resources. So, respectfully, while the court, in trying to excuse its acknowledged mistake, reached for that and pointed out that a separate hearing was not requested, that's not necessary. And the parties, including F.H. Furr, knew that at trial. On the very first day of trial, F.H. Furr's counsel, in arguing regarding the admissibility of a piece of evidence, told the court that a statute of limitations issue remains for decision. That will have to be addressed. The parties all knew here that the statute of limitations issue remained. The parties to that end also elicited testimony at trial regarding whether Furr exercised due diligence and when, if Furr had exercised due diligence, it would have discovered the supposed fraud here.
So, as I understand you correctly, basically your point is, so I'll raise it in the plea and bar, so what? I had a right to raise it before trial, but I had no duty to. I can raise any affirmative defense I want to at trial, unless I overtly waive it, and I didn't do that.
Under facts here, that's absolutely correct. I don't think there's anything nefarious here. I think part of the complication may have arisen from the fact that the original judge retired while the case was proceeding. So the case went to a new judge, new circuit judge. Here, when the court had expressly deferred ruling because there was fact-finding, and the parties knew at trial that this remained for resolution, everybody knew this made sense. The issues overlap. There's no requirement that a statute of limitations
be. I guess the question is, why are we asking whether or not you can raise a plea and bar trial? Why aren't we merely asking, can you raise an affirmative defense at trial that you chose not to raise before trial in a plea and bar procedural context?
I think that's absolutely fair. I think that can happen. Here, especially where Ferguson initially was going to bring forward the statute of limitations plea, but the judge said, absolutely, we cannot do this now. We cannot hear this right now. It requires fact-finding.
So in theory, you could have said, or someone could have said, oh, I changed my mind. Forget all this plea and bar stuff. I don't want to worry about this. Let's just do it all at once. I'll see you at trial.
Under the facts here, where you have a complex case with overlapping facts between the statute of limitations defense or the plea and bar, regardless of what the plea and bar is, and the merits of the claims, I think that makes absolute sense. And in fact, will avoid the risk of inconsistent fact-finding by different juries that are going to be hearing the same witnesses testifying to the same, regarding the same allegedly fraudulent conversations.
So it would be logical then, if at trial you had said this to the judge, yeah, I waived my plea and bar. I got that. A plea and bar means I can resolve this before trial. I didn't do that. I waived it. So what? I still want to defend myself on my affirmative defense, which I've pledged.
Then you would have an affirmative case of waiver. And I think in case law, it shows that if you affirmatively waive...
God, but don't misunderstand my question. I think you can say that. You can waive your plea and bar, but still maintain your defense. You haven't waived your defense. You've just waived the right to raise the defense before trial.
That is correct, Your Honor. I apologize. I misunderstood your question. Yes, I think in that case, you can absolutely do that. here, simply put, whether there's no waiver whatsoever by Ferguson, whether by not refiling, adhering to the words of the court's order, or by not requesting that the court convene a separate jury at a separate time.
I may be misconstruing Fur's argument, and the original order was sort of different. It reduced you to filing an answer as opposed to filing any defenses with regard to part of the case. And so it was very specific in what you could and could not do. I agree with that. I understand their argument to perhaps be that when the court said you needed an evidentiary hearing, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying you needed fact-finding, that maybe the court was signaling that you needed to bring this plea and bar on early. That may not be their argument, but I think that may be
their argument. I think it could be their argument, Your Honor, but that is just not what the court's order said. Although the court order referred to an evidentiary hearing, fact-finding at a hearing, that was not in the so ordered portion of the order. The order only required Ferguson to file a specific pleading, specific an answer and responsive pleading. It did not require that if you are going to assert this plea and bar, it must be at a specific hearing.
Respectful. Let me ask you, you say you need a new trial. This is a really laborious, involved case. What's wrong with a discrete, assuming you're right, and there's no preservation, any of that, why not have a discrete hearing, as in the context of a plea and bar, you know, to just address this discrete issue? I don't understand why we necessarily need a whole new trial.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that we don't need a new trial, but for a different reason, and that being that this court, based on the evidence, the overwhelming evidence of Fur's lack of due diligence, could render judgment. But addressing your question directly, Your Honor, here, and this court has held that when a jury is improperly instructed, the remedy that is necessary is a new trial de novo. That is true because it affected Ferguson's trial strategy. Ferguson, in anticipation of presenting its statute of limitations defense to the jury, elicited testimony from FHR's witnesses that tended to suggest Ferguson made misrepresentations, but that Fur knew that. And that is inconsistent with the ultimate defense on liability that Ferguson was putting forward, that which it still believes today, that there were no misrepresentations. So because it infected Ferguson's trial strategy and the evidence that was adduced, Ferguson will be materially prejudiced without a new trial here. And the court, I believe it was in the Grimsley case cited in the briefing, held exactly that when a jury is not instructed on a defense's theory of the case, new trial de novo is required.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is John Quinn. I represent FH for Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning, Inc. in this case. Ferguson is asking here that this court overturn a jury verdict of the Prince William County Circuit Court after an 8 or 9 day trial in a complex case involving thousands of exhibits.
They raised an affirmative defense that was never heard by the judge or the jury that has some facial plausibility to it. And the reason why that was never heard is because the trial judge said you can't raise an affirmative defense at trial if you've already raised it once in a pretrial motion that was held in abeyance. How can he say that? Where's the law that supports that? Suppose if I'd have been there in that situation, I'd have stood up and said, you have no right to do that. It's my affirmative defense. I waive my plea and bar. I don't want to hear it before trial. I want to hear it at trial. That's my trial strategy. It's my case.
Your Honor, I think we contend, Your Honor, there are many reasons why Ferguson waived any plea and bar in this case or the affirmative defense.
No, I'm conceding in my whole argument to you, they did waive their plea and bar. Of course they did. A plea and bar is a procedural device. It's not a defense. It's just a procedure, a pretrial procedure. They didn't want a pretrial procedure. They decided they wanted to just go to trial and just deal with it all at once. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, the scheduling order required that they notice that
plea and bar.
Plea and bar, notice it for a hearing. If they wanted a jury to decide, what ordinarily happens in these cases, frankly, is that many of these things get resolved by a jury at trial. If you comply with the scheduling order, that was an agreed order.
You can raise a plea and bar for any affirmative defense. for res judicata, for waiver, for estoppel, for collateral estoppel, for statute of limitations, for latches. And the failure to raise a plea and bar does not waive an affirmative defense. And your case is, well, they did raise it. It was held in abeyance because you needed evidence, and they decided not to use the pre-trial procedure, to use the trial procedure. Obviously, they waived their plea and bar, which is pre-trial. But they didn't waive their affirmative defense, did they?
First of all, secondly, Your Honor, they did not assert the affirmative defense as a grounds of defense with their
okay,
answer.
Okay, that's a different issue, but they have a pretty careful response to that, which is they raised it ahead of time in response of pleadings. You don't need to put it in the answer. You need to put it in a response of pleading. And they were told to file an answer, not to refile the response of pleading. That procedural device would have worked to default them, but it seems hardly applicable here.
Your Honor, there's a concept that we mentioned that came in a Kulik case that this court decided was not published, and we attached it to our pleadings. And it's the concept of invited error. And that is what happened here. You know, in Virginia, we have unique rules that allow lawyers to move their cases forward by putting motions on the docket, particularly special pleas. But along with that come certain obligations.
Counsel, it's ironic that you would mention invited error at this point. I want to ask a question about that.
Yes.
Were you trial counsel?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me how to square the following two statements. Okay. Joint Appendix 1575. Counsel for Furr stated, quote, there's a statute of limitations issue, I think, still in this case,
yes.
End quote. Joint Appendix 2021, counsel for Ferguson, counsel for Furr then stated, quote, we had the plea and bar. It was a long time ago. It was heard. I can't square those two statements. And if, in fact, that's exactly what was said, it appears to me to be invited error, inviting the court to not make a ruling on the plea and bar of the statute of limitations.
Your Honor, first of all, the first quotation is, I think, taken very much out of context. What happened there was a document, Furr's contention in this case, in fact, the only evidence, it learned about the fraud scheme when it received a copy of a lawsuit that was filed in the U.S. District Court in Maryland, and that was January 9th, 2013. And at the end of the first day of trial, Ferguson expressed some concerns that we were going into the merits of that complaint, which we really had not done. And the response was, I said that we had just learned over the weekend before trial that Ferguson was requesting a jury instruction on the statute of limitations. This was something that had been sitting there for 4 years. And so that was just at the top of my mind. It was also relevant, of course, to our burden of proof on reasonable reliance. So, yes, I didn't say that they had a right to a jury trial on the statute of limitations. I only said there's an issue, because they've now given us, I didn't say they gave us juries, but there is an issue now that we were just becoming aware of. Ferguson didn't stand up and say, well, yes, we do. We are demanding a jury trial on that.
Okay. I accept your answer at face value. Setting that answer about the statement on page 1570, Joint Appendix 1575, setting that aside, nonetheless, on 2021, you told the court, we had a plea and bar, it was a long time ago, it was heard. That statement alone invited error. The
Your
court
Honor.
Agreed with you, and I'm not imparting any improper motive on either you or the court. You were both mistaken.
Your Honor,
and that's why we're here. That one, out of a 9-day trial, that one colloquy over a period of a minute or two is why we're here.
Your Honor, I think you will find in the record that the judge observed that he had already ruled on that plea and bar before we made that statement. frankly, when I heard it, we were troubled in the two days leading up to trial, because we learned we thought the statute of limitations, frankly, was gone too. It was forgotten about. Then we saw the jury instructions, and we realized we were going to have an issue here. But when it was first raised in a motion to strike after the close of our evidence, that was the first time they raised it. The judge thought he had decided that issue. And my reaction to that was, oh, gee, maybe he's right. And Mr. Vogelman, who's here too, sort of had the same reaction. That's what happened. But the judge first ruled that...
So you didn't know if he was right or wrong?
That's correct.
So you didn't go to trial unprepared to deal with the issue?
Yes.
So you were prepared to deal with the issue at trial and did deal with the issue at trial?
No. When the judge said that I've already decided that issue, our reaction was,
maybe
he's right.
Well, maybe he's wrong. So you went to trial with maybe I need to defend myself on an obvious defense to a very long period of time on statute of limitations?
Not really, Your Honor, because a lot of the trial was devoted to the issue of the element of fraud. Reasonable reliance was a major part of our case, and it's the exact same issue. The instruction is the same, verbatim language is the same, the jury instructions, it's the same issue.
So that takes prejudice off the table. Whatever the procedural rule is we adopt, it can't be because you were blindsided, because you didn't even know for sure that it had been decided ahead of time. And it was intertwined with all the other issues.
Your Honor, we're not claiming that we were necessarily blindsided. We think the judge was blindsided. We think it was very unfair to the trial judge for Ferguson to do this. If it had followed the court's order, and Ferguson was ordered to put its pleas and bar on it for a hearing before trial, if they had done that, and they had...
Where were they ordered to do that?
In the scheduling.
In the scheduling.
Yes, it's right in there. They were required to do that, and they didn't do it. If they had done that, they would have gone in and they could have either presented evidence either to the court or a jury. We say they waived the jury hearing. That's a totally separate hearing issue because they had that earlier hearing, which I'll get to in a minute. But they could have put the evidence on at that time before trial, or they could have simply said, as happens routinely in circuit courts, Your Honor, we'd like to have this heard at trial with based on the evidence at trial.
Okay, so
but they didn't do that.
So they had to give a courtesy call to the trial court? I've got an affirmative defense. I know I can bring it ahead of trial. I've actually brought it ahead of trial. But I'd rather just deal with it. So if they don't make that courtesy call to the court, they waive an affirmative
defense? Well, I think that's the ruling of this court, Your Honor, in a couple of cases, in the Van Marter case, that says, first of all, if you notice your plea and bar before a judge, that's a waiver before of a jury hearing.
They clearly waived their plea and bar. That, to me, is indisputable. A plea and bar is a pretrial exit strategy. They didn't do it. So they didn't do a pretrial exit strategy. They decided to wait to trial, which is the default principle in terms of that's where you normally raise your defenses, at trial. But as I understood the last colloquy you just had with us, that would have been perfectly okay if they had just said that to sometime before trial. You know, don't worry about the plea and bar, Judge. We've decided to withdraw that. You're waiving the plea and bar, counsel? Yes, I'm waiving the plea and bar. I'm not interested in doing this pretrial. I'm going to do this at trial. It's too complicated. It's going to take forever. We might as well just do it all at once. Okay, thank you. So if they had done that, that would have been okay with you?
Your Honor, they also did not submit it as a grounds of defense. So if they waived the plea and bar, they had no defense. And that's what they did.
The reason for a grounds of defense is to provide notice. They provided notice through an affirmative pleading, through a responsive pleading, which is what the rules require.
Well, there's an issue.
And in fact, they understood that. The trial judge said, and I'm going back, this is the page before 2021, where it appears the error was, if not invited, at least confirmed by counsel for FIR. The court said, you're not suggesting that I submit the plea and bar to the jury, are you? And Ferguson's response is perfectly consistent. We are raising the statute of limits defense to the fraud claim. So no, it's not a matter of, jury, here is a plea and bar, let the court explain to you what a plea and bar is, and now we are asking you to rule upon it. Ferguson says, no, we're asking you to submit a jury instruction on the statute of limitations. And how is it that they're not allowed to do that? Again, as Justice Kelsey pointed out, the plea and bar was gone, but the notice of the defense was still there.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the jury hearing on plea and bar was waived also. That's what this court said in the Van Marter case.
They were not asking the jury to hear a plea and bar. They were asking the jury to be instructed on a statute of limitations defense. They're not the same.
Again, I fall back to the fact that they never filed a grounds of defense on the statute of limitations either. That's
having raised the statute of limitations in a responsive pleading, are they also required to then raise it yet a second time in a second responsive pleading? Is there a case that says that?
Not that I am aware of, but what the cases say is what we say here is that you waive a jury. Specifically, the Hawthorne case said, if you elect, and there are a couple, if you elect to have it heard by a judge, you it's an election, and you waive a jury hearing on it. So the trial judge could very easily have said, I'm going to decide this plea and bar myself. Because you waived a jury hearing on the plea and bar, and that includes the defense. I think if they had, in most of the cases you see that they cite are cases where the parties also alleged the statute of limitations as an affirmative defense. They didn't do that. All they did is put on a plea and bar, then they waived the plea and bar. What if the trial, this trial judge, and the plea and bar, by the way, was not to the second amended complaint, it was to an earlier complaint. When they filed their initial complaint, they filed the plea and bar. We filed an amended complaint. Then they filed another plea and bar. Then they noticed it for a hearing before the...
But your amended complaint on the fraud count was identical word for word to your first complaint.
On the first two counts, yes, it
which
was.
Which is what we're referring to, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was. But nevertheless, it wasn't. It was not.
Are they required to re-answer when an amended complaint is word for word, when a count is word for word?
Your Honor, that's what the trial court held. I'm not aware of any case precedent. However, the trial court, a lot of this is fairness to the trial judge. All you had was a plea and bar. Buried in relation to the first amended complaint, not the second amended complaint, and then never ever addressed, even though the rules required them to bring it up, while they were specifically ordered to bring it up, and they just didn't do anything at all about it until after we rested our case. Now I see my time is up, but I'd like to talk just a little bit about the issue of harmless
your time
error.
Has expired.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
May it please the Court again, Your Honors. I just want to address a couple very quick points that Mr. Quinn brought up during argument here. Mr. Quinn referred to the scheduling order and said that somehow required Ferguson to bring its plea and bar, its affirmative defense of the statute of limitations for hearing separate from trial. It did not purport to do any such thing. The language that quotes there referred to dispositive motions only, not affirmative defenses and responsive pleadings. Nor did Ferguson somehow
wait. Can you cite me to the page of the appendix you're referring to, please?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The portion of the scheduling order is Joint Appendix 417, where it says, all dispositive motions shall be presented to the court for hearing as far in advance of trial as practical. Did not refer to special pleas. Refers to a parenthetical in the order that defines dispositive motions as special pleas. That is not, that language just doesn't appear in the order. Again, page 417.
Wouldn't a statute of limitations, if successful, defense or plea and bar be a dispositive motion?
Well, here, I think a plea and bar is, it could be dispositive, certainly. It's a responsive pleading, however, not a motion. And it's worth mentioning that FHFR did not raise this issue to the trial court at all to give the trial court an opportunity to find that Ferguson somehow violated the scheduling order. There's no fact-finding, and even the right reason, wrong reason, right result doctrine does not apply here. That argument is waived and cannot be brought. Nor did Ferguson somehow waive its jury right, relied on the jury demand for jury resolution of all issues. And to the harmless error point that Mr. Quinn referred to obliquely, even the trial court did not hold that somehow the jury, by finding reasonable reliance, found the statute of limitations defense not satisfied.
Can I go back before we lose all of your time, go back to the 1:18 scheduling order.
Sure.
The form order, of course, does say, you know, all dispositive motions, including plea and bar. But suppose it had said that here. I mean, I'm not sure how that affects the case at all. If you waived your plea and bar, that the whole point of that provision in the order is to say, if you want to bring something before trial, you got to bring it before trial.
That's right.
Want to bring it before trial, you don't have to bring it before trial.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. An affirmative defense remains. It was pled in a responsive pleading. Whether or not that was brought before trial is irrelevant. The affirmative defense remained. Ferguson still had its right to that defense. Nothing here was waived. There was no voluntary, intentional relinquishment of a right. I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.